So just a recap of where we were at the end of the morning lecture. So here I'm introducing a new notation for the divergence of our velocity field. So that's the uppercase theta. In case you can't quite recognize that, I wouldn't blame you. But that's, so typically it's denoted either lowercase theta or uppercase theta, depending on who's doing the writing. So in my handwritten notes, I use lowercase theta, but then I discovered along the way that that might create confusing notations later down the road when I'm using angles. And anyway, doesn't matter. So here's a notation for the divergence of the vector field. And from the discussion this morning, we recognize this as a measure of the fractional rate of change of the volume of a fluid element. And we're going to call this the rate of expansion. Sometimes theta is being referred to as the expansion, but I think it's more correct to, you know, to use the phrase rate of expansion because it's really on a per unit time basis. Okay, so that's where we were this morning, and then I'm going to look into the remaining components of the velocity gradient and try to come up with some understanding of what they might mean. Before I get into that, something I meant to talk about this morning, but I don't think it's too late. So the first homework assignment is due next week, I believe. So I just wanted to comment on this a little bit. So most of you have probably got started on that. At least it's a good idea to get started early on that. So there are questions on the first homework, but that's going to be true also for the remaining homework assignments where you're meant to calculate components of a Christoffel symbols or components of a Riemann tensor or things like that that would be very tedious to do, you know, by hand. So I think it would be, you know, a matter of cruelty to insist that you do all of those calculations by hand. And I think, you know, as a relativist, I think it's good if once in your life you calculate a Riemann tensor by hand to just appreciate how much pain is required in order to do that. But once that's done, you should have the freedom of doing those computations on a computer. So what I'll hope for you is that you have access to either Maple or Mathematica or whatever else you might use for symbolic calculations. And all of those softwares have packages built in or coming from the outside where you can actually do tensor calculations. You specify a metric, you define a tensor, and then, you know, it will calculate the components for you. So I think it's perfectly you know, fine for you to use a computer to do those very routine calculations because the point is not to show that you can do that. Anybody can do that. The point of the exercises is to reflect on some of the stuff that we've talked about. So it's not the routine stuff that I'm worried about. It's the more reflective part of the problems that I think I really want you to focus on. So that's just to say that if you feel worried about using the computer for some of your calculations, don't. It's perfectly fine. If you've never used those packages for tensor calculations, well, here's an excellent opportunity to find a way to do that. You might need to invest a little bit of time to do it, but you'll thank me forever after that because it really helps for anything else you might have to do in your life having to do with tensors. So while we're on the subject, any questions about the first homework assignment? All good? Okay. I should be posting the second one, you know, within a day or two. I'll put that on CourseLink, you know, pretty soon. Okay. So let's look into other components of the velocity gradient. And what we're going to do now is to think of decomposing a tensor. And the tensor that I'm, you know, thinking about here is, you know, working in Cartesian coordinates because we're doing Newtonian mechanics, the gradient, the full gradient of the velocity field. And as I said before, the reason why we want to decompose it is because, well, that's a complicated object with 9 independent components. And instead of trying to understand the whole piece all at once, we can try to break it down into smaller pieces that individually we can understand better. And one of those pieces is the divergence. And then, you know, if you're thinking of your vector calculus, well, that's one of the pieces. The curl of a vector field would be another piece. And then there's other pieces beyond that. So we want to break it down like this and try to understand things better. So this is 9 components, and that's something that I would consider to be complicated, and we want to break it down into smaller pieces. So I'll introduce the notation VAB so I can save myself some writing. And in fact, for the next little while, I could be talking about the decomposition of an arbitrary tensor, but I will apply those ideas to the velocity gradient as a concrete illustration. But a lot of what we're going to do now would apply to any two-index tensor in Cartesian tensor in Newtonian mechanics. All right. So this is an object that doesn't have any symmetry. So sometimes we're given a tensor and it's defined to be either symmetric under a switch of indices or anti-symmetric under a switch of indices. Well, this has no such symmetry. But the first thing we're going to do is to break it up into two pieces, one that's going to be symmetric, the other one that's going to be anti-symmetric. And already with that step, we've sort of broken it down into smaller pieces and simpler pieces. So if we're dealing with a two-index object, we can always take its fully symmetric combination, and the standard notation for this is a bracket around the indices. And this is simply, well, take the tensor, take the transpose of the tensor, and add the pieces and multiply by a half. So it's basically the average of the matrix and its transpose. And then there's another piece to it, which would be the fully antisymmetric part of the tensor, and that's, you know, the bracket, the square bracket notation is standard for this, and that would be by definition the tensor minus its transpose. And then of course you see right away that the full tensor can always be broken up into a symmetric piece and an antisymmetric piece, both of which are smaller and simpler than the original tensor. So that's the first thing that typically we would do. And, you know, we have something here involving 9 components because it's symmetric. If you think of it as a 3x3 matrix, but then you make sure that it's symmetric, then you go from 9 and you kill 3, and that gives you 6 independent components. And then if you think of an antisymmetric matrix, you know, you cannot have any entries on the diagonal. The entries below the diagonal are going to be minus the entries on the above the diagonal, so this comes with 3 independent components. So already we have something smaller, and smaller in our, you know, thinking here means simpler and presumably easier to describe in terms of what they do physically. So that's already a good first step. The next step is to take that symmetric tensor, and we're going to break it down into a trace part and a trace-free part. And again, I think it's helpful to think of the matrix representation of this. The trace part would be something proportional to the identity matrix with, you know, 1 coefficient in front. And then the trace-free part, well, would be something that has a vanishing trace. So the next, the next layer of decomposition would be to take a symmetric matrix and break it down into a trace piece and a trace-free piece. And because we're dealing with Cartesian tensors here, the natural object to use as, to define the trace piece will be the identity matrix. So it's going to be the Kronecker delta. That's the metric in Cartesian coordinates. And, you know, in the end, we're going to generalize this to something that would be suitable for curved spacetime. But let me just write it as 1/3 theta, same theta we had before if we're talking about the velocity gradient. That will multiply the identity matrix, namely the Kronecker delta. And then we're going to have a remaining piece that's going to be, again, in fairly standard notation, it's going to be a trace-free tensor, and the angular brackets here is what is typically used for notation on this. And the requirement here is that, well, if we take the trace of that object, namely multiplied by the metric or the Kronecker delta, then that's defined to be 0. So here we have a further decomposition. We introduce, initially we have an object that has, six independent components, one of which is going to be given by the trace part, that coefficient in front of the identity matrix. And that thing here, what's left over, is going to have five independent components. So again, the idea is to break it down into as small pieces as we can come up with. And by the time we're done doing this, well, it's pretty much it. So there's no way of breaking it down further. That's what we're dealing with. So theta here, would be in general the trace of the original the original symmetric part of that tensor. So if you multiply, the equation here through the left-hand side by a delta, a Kronecker delta, then you're going to generate 1/3 theta times delta delta. So that's the identity matrix multiplied to the identity matrix taking the trace. So that gives you 3. So, multiply the identity matrix by the identity matrix, that gives you the identity matrix. Take the trace of the identity matrix in 3 dimensions, that's 3. So we kill that factor of 1/3, that's why I inserted it. And then the, what's remaining here would be what you get after you take the original symmetric part of the tensor and you take out the trace part. You end up with something that, of course, will be trace-free. So that's how you can compute all of those individual pieces. The symmetric part you do by symmetrization, the antisymmetric part you do by antisymmetrization. And then beyond that, you calculate the trace and you put it in front of the identity matrix with the 1/3. And then the remaining part is what's left over after all of this. So you can break it down into, much smaller objects than the initial thing. So if we put it all together, then we have a decomposition for the velocity gradient. So now I'll specialize to this, where we have, first of all, the symmetric piece that comes with the divergence, theta, or the rate of expansion, as we're going to call it. And then we have the symmetric trace-free part. And then we have the antisymmetric part. And that's about as complete a decomposition we can actually come up with. So we went from 9 individual components to a breakdown in terms of 1 component, 5 components, and 3 components. So each piece being smaller and therefore easier to understand in terms of what it might do than the full original thing. All right, so that's good. We could keep going, actually, because we have 3 individual components here, we could actually think of this as, representing a vector. And in tensor calculus, vector calculus, we always do that. That defines the curl, essentially. So if we define what that is, just as an example, if I take the xy component of the velocity gradient, so of course, if any one of the indices here are equal, we get 0 by antisymmetrization. But if we take x and y, for example, as components, if we look up the definition, that's going to be the x derivative of the vy component, and then minus the antisymmetric portion of this. And if you remember your formulas for the curl, well, that's exactly with the 1/2, that's exactly the z component of the velocity vector. So we could think of re-expressing this antisymmetric tensor here in terms of a vector. So I could keep going like this, v, y, z, antisymmetric, that's going to be y derivative of z component minus the opposite, and that, apart from the 1/2, is the x component of the curl, and then, might as well complete this. That would be the y component of the curl. So, because we're in 3 dimensions, the antisymmetric part of the tensor has 3 individual components. independent components, and we can always establish a one-to-one correspondence between the curl, and I could introduce notation for this. It would involve the epsilon symbol. You may have encountered that previously. You can find that in the notes, but I'm not going to bother too much here. But anyway, we do recognize the various pieces, right? So this is the familiar divergence. This is the, you know, familiar curl. And what's left over here, we still have five components. Well, all, you know, those are all the things that are not captured by divergence or curl. So it's kind of interesting that for doing electromagnetism, all we have, all we need in terms of, you know, gradients of tensors, you know, gradients of the magnetic field or gradients of the electric field, the only pieces that are relevant for electromagnetism are the divergence and curl. But that leaves out all sorts of stuff that presumably might play a role too. And what, you know, what we find typically is that, well, maybe not directly in electromagnetism, but if we were to do fluid dynamics, we would find that this over here does play a role. It's called a shear tensor, and that's something that does play a role, for example, in the Navier-Stokes equation. So I can express it like this. The standard notation is that we call this, sigma. So sigma, by definition, is the same thing as the symmetric trace free part of our gradient field. And then that thing over here, so that will be recognized later on as the rate of shear. We're going to look into the physical meaning of this in the next little while. And then that piece over here, standard notation for this is omega. And that, by definition, is the antisymmetric portion of the velocity gradient. And that's going to be recognized as the rate of rotation. So the full velocity gradient then involves three different rates: rate of expansion, rate of shear, rate of rotation. And those are all the basic ways that the velocity gradient can manifest itself, in this case, in the case of a moving fluid. All right, so we'll work on this, try to firm up our understanding of all of this in the next little while. And then, you know, when we move this to curved space-time, we're going to see that similar objects get introduced in essentially the same sort of way through a decomposition of the full velocity gradient, but now done in space-time. But we're going to see that we can still break it down into recognizable pieces that have exactly the same interpretation as in this simple Newtonian case. So that's why I'm spending the time to do this properly and systematically in the Newtonian setting, because after that we'll be able to rely on this to make the move to four-dimensional space-time. So are we good at this point? So at this point, the interpretation here is not supposed to make sense. That's what I want to describe more fully in the next little part of the lecture. But any questions before I get into that? Okay, good. All right. So, what I'm going to do now is to explore the meaning of all of these things in a simple setting where I can represent what's going on the plane. Turns out that I tend to be challenged trying to draw three-dimensional pictures. Sometimes I can add a little bit of perspective, but it's difficult. I'm not very talented with my drawing abilities. So I'm going to restrict myself to a two-dimensional fluid flow on the plane, pretending that the physics is two-dimensional, even though all of this would apply in three dimensions. It's just that for the purpose of illustration, it's going to help me to describe this in 2D. So we're going to focus on a 2D flow in the XY plane and set anything that depends on Z to zero. So I'm going to say that the Z component of the velocity is a vector is zero. And then I'm going to say that the Z derivative of the VX component, the Z derivative of the VY component, is also zero. So that is just for illustration purposes. It's not an actual physical restriction that I would want to impose. It's just that when I'm going to draw a picture, it's going to be a fully two-dimensional picture. Okay, so let's work out a few things now that we're dealing with this this situation. I guess I'm gonna go over here so that we can leave those equations for us to consult. Okay, so we already know in this situation that I could have left it just like this. So the quantity theta that we've been talking about, the divergence of the vector field, well, in this 2D restriction, that's just the sum of two terms, the y, the x derivative of the x component plus the y derivative of the y component. So in that case, the divergence of the vector field is given by this, and that's going to be something that will represent the rate of change of volume along the flow of the fluid. So that, I think, we have a pretty firm understanding, as it stands. So I'm not going to consider that. So I will be talking about situations where we're going to switch this off so that we can better capture the other components of the velocity gradient. So let's look at the shear, namely the symmetric tracery piece. So what we're going to consider here is a situation where I'm setting off the expansion. So we already know what this does, so we can focus on the other pieces. And I'm going to also switch off the rotation. And what I want, therefore, is a velocity flow that's characterized entirely by a non-vanishing shear tensor. Everything else will vanish. So this will mean that sum of derivatives here will be zero for our flow. And this over here, well, there's only one non-trivial component, because if I look at this and I make all of those restrictions here, this will vanish automatically. This will vanish automatically. So the only thing that's not trivial is that one over here. So omega x y in this case is going to be 1/2 dx vy minus dy vx. And that's something we're going to set equal to zero. So what this means is that we're dealing with the kind of flow where those two derivatives are actually equal to one another. So when we understand shear, I'm going to do the exact opposite. I'm going to set the shear tensor to zero. And we're going to look at a flow where the rotation, the rate of rotation, the omega tensor, is going to be chosen to be non-zero. So that's the idea of breaking a complicated tensor into pieces. And the idea is that we look at each piece individually. And then the general action is going to be a sum of all of the effects that we've identified. So we've already dealt with the divergence part of the velocity field. We understand that. And now I'm focusing entirely on the shear. And to do that, I'm going to make those choices here. All right. So let's look at what we're dealing with in terms of components. So the first component of the shear tensor is going to be the xx component. And that, by definition, is going to be the sum of the symmetrized velocity gradient. And because the two indices are the same, we're talking about the sum of identical terms. So it's really just dx vx. And let's see, I think I want to introduce notation for this. I'll just call this sigma plus, just to facilitate the writing down the road. So we have that. We have that sigma xy. Well, that's going to be the sum of the, again, symmetrized gradient. So we have that. And we have equality between those two terms. So by the chosen flow and the vanishing of omega, we choose those two quantities here to be exactly the same. So this is either going to be this or that. And I'm going to call that sigma cross. If you know something about gravitational waves, it's no accident that I'm using the plus and cross notation here, because we'll see that the action of sigma is actually very analogous to the action of a gravitational wave passing through. And then, okay, sigma y, that's the only non-zero component left after I made, you know, the choices that I made and eliminate the z component to everything as I did before, then that's going to be again 2 times half of dy vy. And that's the same thing as minus dx vx. And that's the same thing as what I called minus sigma plus. So bottom line here is that if we represent the shear tensor as a matrix, we're going to have a non-zero entry here, sigma plus, a non-zero entry here. It's symmetric, so it's got to be the same thing over here. And then we get minus the same thing as up here. I'm suppressing the third dimension here, because everything is two-dimensional. And we see, sure enough, that you know, this is a matrix that is actually trace-free. If you take the trace, you get zero. Okay, so we want to understand the action of that thing. So we want to look at a fluid element, and we want to see that if we have a flow such that sigma is the only non-vanishing piece of the velocity gradient, we want to see how that fluid element will evolve in time. So what I'm going to do here is to look at, you know, we're working on the plane, so we're going to look at a square fluid element. And I'm going to draw that fluid element to be around the origin of the xy coordinates. So I'm going to pick that element that happens to be at the origin like this. I'm going to draw it as a square. And I'm going to pick a reference frame so that the overall velocity of that fluid element is zero. So what's interesting to me here is the relative velocity of any piece of the fluid element with respect to the, you know, point at the origin. So if I imagine myself moving with the fluid element, then I can set up a reference frame that's co-moving with the fluid element such that the velocity at the center is going to be zero. So that's going to give me the simplest description of the fluid element. And what's important to us to understand what the velocity gradient does is going to be the difference between the velocity at the center here, which is zero, and all the non-zero values for the velocity vector as we go around the fluid element. That's what we want to describe and understand if we're talking about a pure shear flow like this. So we're going to do this. So we have a square fluid element around the origin in a frame such that the velocity at the center, so let's call that the origin, is actually zero. So we're moving with the fluid element, but only moving with, you know, the center of mass of that fluid element. What I want to know is how the velocity will change as I go away from the center. So the velocity around the origin, well, that's something I can express as a Taylor expansion. So we're looking at a very small neighborhood around the origin, and I can say that the x component of the velocity at any point within the fluid element, well, it's going to be the value at the center, which is zero. I'll write it out in full so that we understand what we're doing here. So it's going to be the value at the center plus a first order derivative plus a second order derivative. But, you know, we're going to stop at first order. So the first thing that I'm going to get is the x derivative of the velocity at the center multiplying x. And we're going to have the y derivative of the x velocity multiplying y. And then we would have second order derivatives in this Taylor expansion of the velocity field around that central point. So the idea is that we're going to pick that to be zero by convention. And we're going to identify the velocity gradient terms here in terms of the shear tensor. So let me write down the Taylor expansion for, well, let me complete the story here. So that is something that we called sigma plus before. And that's something that we called sigma cross before. So the shear tensor is going to give us the Taylor expansion of the velocity field around the origin. And that's how we're going to see how the fluid element changes its shape in the course of the motion. All right, so that was for Vx. For Vy, well, we get the value at the center, which is still going to be zero. Then we're going to get the x derivative of the Vy component at the center, multiplying x, plus the y derivative of the y component, multiplying y, plus higher order derivatives that I will ignore. And again, we can relate this to our shear tensor. So this is also something that I called sigma cross before. You know, that's the calculation we did up there. And that's minus sigma plus. So bottom line is that the velocity field anywhere in that fluid element, I can express, you know, at least as an approximation, as sigma plus times x plus sigma cross times y, and then I'll ignore the higher order terms. And then the y velocity is going to be sigma cross times x minus sigma plus times y. And all we have to do now is to map this and see what the fluid element will be doing as time goes on. All right, so the initial, so what I'll do here is to focus on each component in turn. So we can still decompose that further by just looking at those two individual components separately. So we'll look at a sigma plus situation first, and then we'll look at a sigma cross situation next. So if I'm focusing on sigma plus only, then the velocity field simplifies further, and we'll get sigma plus times x and minus sigma plus times y. So that's the velocity field we have to understand. And what I'm going to do is to just redraw that fluid element. I'm going to draw the initial shape at t equals zero in dotted lines like this. And then we're just going to see what the velocity field looks like in that map. This is the y-axis, this is the y-axis. And what I see here is that the vx component of the velocity just goes with x. So if I look at it over here, the velocity goes in that direction. And if I look at over here, well, x is negative, so it's going to go in the opposite direction. So one thing that the flow is going to do here is to stretch in the x direction. The y component of the velocity goes with y, but with a minus sign. So if we look at it up here, it goes in, whereas this other one here goes up. So what the flow will do is to stretch in that direction, squeeze in that direction. And if that reminds you of what a gravitational wave does, it's because it's exactly the same kind of, you know, distortion. A gravitational wave imposes a shear deformation of whatever it goes through. So the new shape of the fluid element after a little time has gone by is going to be elongated like this. So it's going to be a nice rectangle when previously we had a square. So the effect of sigma plus is to produce a stretch in the x direction and a squeeze in the y direction. And if you, you know, think about it a little bit more, what's going to happen is that this whole square here is going to be deformed into a rectangle. But because the expansion is zero, or the divergence of the vector field has been chosen to be zero, that deformation is guaranteed to come with no change in volume. Or, you know, in the two-dimensional picture, no change in area. So we get a shear And by shear, we mean no change in volume. That's accounted for by theta. And if we put theta equal to zero, then we rule out that the deformation will include a rescaling of the volume element. The volume will not change. Instead, we're just squeezing and stretching in a way that preserves the area. No change in volume, and that's the kind of deformation that's known as a shear. And that's, you know, that's a notion that is central in fluid dynamics. It's also central in elasticity theory. So those things this terminology comes from those fields. And because, you know, here I was plotting the velocity field, but the displacement is actually the velocity field times the interval of time, dt. So we're talking about the rate of shear as opposed to just standard shear. So sigma is really the thing that will measure the rate by which that square becomes a rectangle. Right? All good? So after that, it's more or less, you know, more of the same. So here we focused on sigma plus. We can see what sigma cross is doing. And after that, we can see what the rotation part of this, the omega part of this, is doing. And it's all, you know, a very similar game. We just look at the velocity field given the choices that we make and see how it affects the fluid element and identify the basic actions that the velocity gradient gives us. So any questions up to now? Okay, good. So let's keep going. So let's do sigma cross. If we focus on sigma cross, then Vx will go with y, and Vy will go with x. So that's a rather different flow, but we can map it out as we did before. So here's the two axes. Here's the initial square. And now, if we follow the equations here, we see that Vx goes with y. So what this means is that if we're up here, Vx will be positive, so it's going to be pushing this way. But if we're down here, Vx will be negative, so it's going to be pushing that way. And then Vy goes with x, so if we're over here, Vy goes this way. But if we're down here, it goes the other, you know, it goes the other way. So what this gives rise to then is going to be a shape that's going to be sort of, you know, squeezed in that direction. And here I have typically a hard time drawing this, but it's going to look like, I did it pretty well in the notes, so it looks like, looks like this. So this corner here moves out like that, that corner moves out like this, and those two corners move in, so it goes like that. So that's another type of deformation that's, you know, pictorially different from the rectangle, but it's also a shear, but now a shear in, you know, in a different direction. So this is also shear, and it's also corresponding to no change in volume, or in this case, area. So bottom line is, when we write down the velocity gradient like this, we can understand this as being the overall change in volume of the fluid element as it goes through the flow. And now we see that this, which is sigma, that's something that produces a deformation of the fluid element without affecting the volume. And now that we have those two pieces, you know, understood, I think we have a much better handle on the velocity gradient. We can see how each piece does something very specific. And that's the idea of the decomposition, was to understand the action and the meaning of each piece separately. And after that, it's basically just a superposition of all of those effects taken together. So now we've got this worked out, we've got this worked out, and now the only thing that's left to do is to look at what the omega tensor does. And as the name indicates, we're going to see that it corresponds to a rotation of the fluid element. We're going to see how that happens in just a minute. Yep?
So here you did not have Vy, and somehow it seems that we are going to get a torque. how that is not sufficient?
No, there's no torque, so that will be captured by the omega tensor, because that's how you get your rotation.
So we can cross without V by? V by zero, but sigma cross is there.
Vy is not zero, right? It scales with x.
Yeah,
if it's not there, then you don't have a shear, because the shear requires those derivatives to be the same, right? So those two things have to be the same under the action of a shear. Yeah, so the things are coupled together, right? Other questions?
The reason is a very first grade fluid dynamics. When we see this, if I apply a force, for example, to a side of an elastic material, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be deformed in a way that the layers, they go up.
Right.
But I'm not getting that here. That's why. I mean, it's a little bit different from my...
Oh, but it's not vastly different, because if you want to produce a velocity gradient across a fluid or an elastic fluid, you have to have forces acting. And, you know, you can think of this as being the disguised action of a force acting on the fluid, right? If you didn't have any force, you would have a constant velocity throughout the fluid. If you want to have a gradient, that means that you have differential forces acting on each fluid element, and basically we're breaking it down. And so we're not thinking in terms of force, but we're thinking purely in kinematical terms. But yeah, ultimately there's going to be a force behind all of this.
Yeah, right. Right. I understand that part. My point is that the form of deformation. So now I'm seeing that it's like this or this, or the cross is going to get stretched across. Yeah, but what if the layers move on top of each other, and then it would be like
Well, you know, think of it in terms of that picture, right? So here, so I think I see what you mean.
I mean, the top and the bottom is almost the same, but it gets just deformed.
Right, but it's like a layer. So if we're working in a frame where the center doesn't move, then if there's relative motion between two layers, that means that one will come with positive velocity, the other one will come with negative velocity, and that's what we're seeing here, right? But here the point is that, well, it's not enough to just have a variation with x, because of the, you know, definition of the shear. If one, you know, by conservation of mass, conservation of volume, what we have to have is also motion in the y direction. So we cannot just break it down in terms of a pure gradient in the x direction. So that's probably the key thing, right? Right. So typically in fluid flows, we have combinations of all of these things, whereas here we really insist that we want to have each piece in isolation. And, you know, I think that's more conducive to a better understanding than to try to consider all aspects altogether. Yep, good question, thank you. Anything more on just the shear? Yep.
So, I think there's just like a piece missing in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I don't know, but normally when we start this sort of talk, like an undergrad, talk about Dave Gregor, all that kind of stuff, we're sort of focused on the gradient or the divergence of the curl.
Right.
And that's, I guess, because of the Helmholtz decomposition. You can represent any vector field with the divergence of the scalar and the curl vector.
Yeah, right.
And so I'm trying to get some intuition for the emergence of the shear here.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's not something that I thought about recently. So it's true that we have this Helmholtz theorem that says that if you know the divergence and the curl of a vector field, you can reconstruct the vector field. But I don't think it means that the decomposition of the gradient can only involve the divergence and the curl. So there's still other pieces.
The I feel like there's a connection point that I'm missing.
Yeah, I think I'm missing it too, but that's an interesting, an interesting thought. Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna have to let it hanging for now. Yeah. Okay, so let's do what the rotation is doing. And it's basically just doing more of what we just did. So let's go back to another board. So I think I want to, yeah, I want to keep this one. Okay, so so before we were looking at the shear separately, so now let's look at the rotation separately. And we're going to set up a situation again where we take out the divergence because we know what it does. We're going to take out the shear because now we know what it does. And the only thing left over in the velocity gradient is going to be the rotation. And because we work in 2D, there's only one, you know, there's a single component there. So, okay, so that tells us again that dx, vx plus dy, vy is zero. So now this will be telling us that dx, vx separately is zero and dy, vy separately is zero. So before we had that, now we don't have that anymore. And the other thing that it tells us is that dx, vy plus dy, vx, that would be the xy component of the shear. Now we set that equal to zero, which means that this will be minus that. So those are the things that we're setting to zero. And then what we're not setting to zero is that component over here. So the vxy component is 1/2 dx dy minus dy vx. And that we're going to set equal to some number. I might call it, I'll call it omega z, because you're going to see why in a moment. It would be, apart from the half, it's the z component of the curl. I think that's the notation. Oh, no. Yeah, that's right. Okay, so if we combine all of those equations, we have that those derivatives are zero. This one tells us that dx vy is going to be minus this one. So let's see, I could work from here. So those two are, you know, minus each other. So this is really the same thing as 1/2 dx vy plus dx vy. So that tells us that dx vy is going to be omega z. And because the other one is minus that, dy v x, that's going to be minus omega z. So those are the only non-zero derivatives that that we're dealing with. So that's what we get after putting everything else to zero, except for the one non-trivial component of the rotation tensor, the omega tensor. And now if I go back to my Taylor expansion and incorporate this information, what I'm going to get is that Vx, we still have the same expansion, but now this derivative is zero, and that one is minus omega z times y. And the other one, if we go back to the expansion over here, that's going to be omega z times x, and that's going to be zero. And that's the velocity field that the omega tensor gives us. And if you remember your vector calculus, this is something I could have re-expressed as the omega vector that has a single z component crossed with the position vector that has x, y, and, you know, a vanishing z component. So that would give us that. And that's something that describes a rotation with angular velocity omega. And omega is the angular velocity. And of course, that corresponds to the rate of rotation. So here we have a pure rotation around the z-axis. If we included more components and a fuller three-dimensional picture, we would be talking about a rotation around, you know, an axis that can be oriented in, you know, in an arbitrary direction. So if you're not convinced by this because you don't remember all of this stuff, well, we can again map it out in the way that we did before. So let me redraw the axes and the initial square shape of our fluid element. And when we look at the velocity field, we see that the x component goes with y. So if we're up here, it's going to be negative. So it's going to go like that. If it's down here, it's going to be positive and go like that. And the y component of the velocity field goes like x. So if we're over here, it's going to be pointing up. And if it's down here, it's going to be pointing down. And if you were to, you know, point this at a few more places in the square, you would see that this is something that just produces an overall rotation, so that you know, after some time, we would get a square, which would still be a square, but now it would be rotated by some angle that's going to be given by, well, the angular velocity omega times the time. So that angle of rotation here would be omega times t, or omega z times t. So that's basically it. So we have a gradient decomposed into three different things, one describing the overall change in the volume of the fluid element, one producing a deformation, a shear deformation, the other one producing an overall rotation. And we can better understand the full gradient by looking at it as a superposition of all of those three irreducible effects, those effects that are, you know, basically independent of one another, but having, you know, that very specific description. Yep.
What is our frame attached to?
I'm following a fluid element.
So then how can we see the rotation?
Oh, so it's an inertial frame, right? So the my frame is not rotating with anything. So if it, you know, if it was moving with the center of mass of the fluid element, it's going to keep its axes pointing in the same direction. Yeah, yeah. So there's nothing preventing us from seeing the, you know, the square being rotated into a rotated square. Yeah. And in this case also, the rotation doesn't affect the volume. It literally just takes the cube and, you know, and rotates it by some angle in some direction. So this also comes with no change in volume, because that's fully accounted for, as we saw before, by the divergence of the vector field. So just to recap everything then, I think now we have achieved our purpose, which was to, so I'm going back to that. We have a full decomposition of a very complicated object, namely the full gradient field, the full gradient of the velocity field, in terms of very simple quantities, and quantities that have an understandable, you know, effect on the flow. So the velocity gradient can be decomposed into a trace part, a symmetric trace-free part, an antisymmetric part, so we're going to write it like this, and that's the rate of expansion. That's the rate of shear. That is a deformation of the fluid element. And that's simply the rate of rotation, namely just a rotation, an overall rotation of the fluid element. Very simple descriptions of all the basic ingredients. And all of that taken together, we have the full velocity gradient, but now broken down into little pieces that can be understood individually a lot better. So that's the purpose of doing this, and that's why it's done all the time in fluid mechanics. It's to, you know, really do that, turn that complicated object into little pieces that can be understood individually so that you can keep track of the physical meaning of all of those things in your equations as you keep on developing the fluid mechanics of that fluid. All right. So that was basically the introduction to the topic. What I want to do now is to introduce the same ideas, but more or less in the same way in a four-dimensional space-time where we would be dealing with, you know, a velocity field in curved space-time. And, you know, it's a step up in complexity because now we have one more dimension to contend with. But it turns out that all the same ideas more or less apply. It's just that we have to generalize them suitably for the new purpose. So before I do that, any questions on what we've done? So just to give you a heads up on what's going to be coming, we're also going to introduce a decomposition of the space-time gradient field of a velocity vector. And we will be introducing objects like the expansion, like the shear tensor, like the rotation tensor. And in a certain sense that I'll make precise along the way, those will have exactly the same interpretation as the Newtonian ones. So the Newtonian ones was not just an introduction in a simpler context. It turns out that it's, you know, almost directly portable to general relativity because of a property that we'll talk about in just a few minutes. Okay, so no questions? Okay, so let's get into that.
One question. Yep. Sorry. Which component was absent for electromagnetism?
Oh, so what I was saying about electromagnetism is that when we do Maxwell's equations, we care about the divergence and the curl of the electric field or the magnetic field, and the other components of the gradient of either one never seem to play an explicit role, and that's true. And I was contrasting that situation to the situation in fluid mechanics, where all the components of the gradient actually do play a role, when you write down the Navier-Stokes equation, for example.
Isn't it because electromagnetism is trace-free, the energy momentum of it?
Yeah, I don't know if I would claim a relationship between that property and the other property. I think it's just an accident of Maxwell's theory that only those derivatives actually play a role, direct role in the Maxwell equations. I don't know if there's anything deeper than this to it.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, thanks. Thanks for the question. Okay, so now let's work in a curved space-time. And let's talk about a space-time velocity field. And we're going to be talking about its gradient. So here the idea is that I'm given, so I have a space-time and there's some metric attached to it, but I'm not going to worry about the properties of that metric. But what I want to introduce in some open region of space-time, so in some, you know, extended domain, I want to introduce a normalized velocity field. And by field, I really mean it's not just defined on one word line. It's going to be defined in, you know, some extended four-dimensional region. So I have a velocity field in the same sense that we were talking about before in the Newtonian discussion. And it's going to be normalized in the usual sense that, you know, the norm of the vector field in the given metric is going to be minus 1. But I'm not going to assume that it's geodesic. I want to keep things fairly general at this stage. I could assume that it's a geodesic vector field, but I'm not going to assume that. And because it's not a geodesic, it could represent the velocity field of a relativistic fluid in curved spacetime. So not necessarily geodesic. So that's, you know, that's assumed to be given. So we have some open region of spacetime where this vector field is defined. And because there's always a one-to-one correspondence between vector fields and their integral curves, given the vector field, we also have the network of integral curves. And that's what I'm calling the congruence of time-like world lines to which that vector field is tangent. So in that open region of space-time, we have a whole bunch of world lines. And so long as the velocity field is well-defined, not singular, we have this set, this congruence of time-like world lines that are, you know, not intersecting, only one passing through each point in space-time. So we have a congruence of time-like world lines. To which U is tangent. And those word lines in general are not going to be geodesics. They're going to be some curves in spacetime. So that's the statement that the U vector is everywhere tangent to those word lines. So those are the integral curves of the vector field. And just to keep things, again, concretely, you know, to keep things concrete from a physical point of view, I'm going to think of this as being the word lines of a fluid. So I can think of a little fluid element moving along each one of those word line, and I can think of the physics satisfied by that fluid element, and that's going to give me some kind of physical anchor on the behavior of the word lines directly. So I'm going to think of those as being the word lines of a fluid element. So the relation to a fluid here is not essential. It wasn't that essential also in the Newtonian context. It's just there to anchor the ideas and to think of something substantial going on here. But the thing that really interests me the most is the behavior of the word lines that's given to us in terms of the behavior of the vector field. All right. So let me set up a couple of things first. So I'm going to introduce the acceleration vector. A alpha, by definition, is going to be the rate of change of the velocity vector along each word line. So it's the covariant derivative in, you know, projected in the direction of the word line itself. And that's the thing that would be zero if we were talking about geodesics, but because it's not zero, we're talking about an accelerated word line in that spacetime. So that's just notation. That's something that will show up as part of the decomposition of the velocity gradient. That's going to be the velocity, you know, the projection of that velocity gradient in the direction of the velocity vector. And something that this vector satisfies, and it's always guaranteed, is that it's going to be orthogonal to the velocity vector itself. So I want to claim that those two vectors are orthogonal in spacetime. And I can claim it, I can even prove it. So the proof is simply to calculate that scalar product. So if I calculate the projection of A on U, so I have U alpha multiplying U beta times the covariant derivative. And I want to claim that this is the same thing as the derivative along U of U alpha. And that's, you know, that's something that we'll probably do over and over again. So it's important to understand what we've just done here. So I wrote it like this, but I'm going to justify that step. I'm going to say that this is one half. I'm going to develop that in full and see what we're getting. So that's going to be the derivative of the first product here. Second product comes along, and then we have the first product coming along for the ride, and then we have the derivative of the second product. And I claim that those are exactly the same things, because what I could do here is to raise the index and lower the index here. I can always freely raise the index inside a covariant derivative, because I can always throw in a metric, and the covariant derivative of the metric is always zero. So basically, I can rewrite this as one half u beta acting on u with the index raised. So I've thrown in a metric, and then I, you know, compensated for that by lowering the index here, and the covariant derivative and the operation of lowering the index actually commute. So this is the same thing as that, but that is the same thing as this. So they're both equal, and they give me this in the end. All right, so that's the first step. The second step is simply to recognize that everywhere in that open region, that scalar product is actually a constant. So I can differentiate that constant, and I'm guaranteed to get zero. So the acceleration vector, regardless of the nature of the velocity field, the acceleration vector is guaranteed to be orthogonal to the velocity field. And that's something that we'll use when it's time to start decomposing things. So we're all good with that little calculation here? Okay, so that's the kind of thing that I'll do over and over again in future lectures. So I won't spend all that time, you know, later on. I'll assume that, you know, you can handle this in your head if we need that. Okay, so that's one thing. The other thing that I'll do is to introduce an object that, again, will be very useful in that decomposition. I'll introduce something that I'll call a projection operator. And the projection operator is going to be a two-index thing. Let's see, how do I want to define that? Okay. And I'm going to define it in terms of the metric, one index up, one index down, and the velocity. Two occurrences of the velocity vector, index alpha, index beta. So that's just the definition. And just as a reminder, that object here, the metric with one index up and one index down, well, that's the same thing as a Kronecker delta. So I could write it as a Kronecker delta like this. I like to write it as a metric because it reminds me that if I lower the index, I get the metric. If I raise the index, I get the inverse metric. So I think the notation is a little bit more informative if I write it like this instead of that, but it's really exactly the same thing. So what's the role of this? Well, the role of that is going to be to kill anything that has a component along u. So the first property is that if I multiply this either on the left or on the right with u, so it's symmetric under the two indices, so it doesn't matter how I do it. But if I multiply by u, then what do I get? I get Kronecker delta plus u acting on u. And if I act with the metric on u, well, I'm not doing anything. That's just a Kronecker delta operation. But here, when I multiply those two u's, I get minus 1. So that operation gives me 0. So that's an object that will allow me to kill the component of a vector that might be lined up with the velocity field. So it keeps the orthogonal direction, the orthogonal components, but it kills that u component of whatever I act with it. So that's something that we'll be using, when we work out our decompositions you know, as we keep going like this. So it's a projection operator, so it satisfies a few interesting properties. For example, if I act with P twice, it doesn't do anything more. So acting with P twice gives me exactly, you know, two actions if P is the same as one single action. And I won't prove this, but you can just prove this by multiplying, you know, making the substitution here and seeing what happens when you do the multiplication. I'm going to ask you to do that on your own. And that's a typical property of projection operators. If you're thinking of your projection operators in quantum mechanics or elsewhere, you know, it doesn't matter how many times you project, you always, you know, need to do it once, and that's good enough. So two operations of projection is the same as one operation of projection. So that's one property that it satisfies. And the other property is the trace property. If we calculate the trace of the projection operator, we're going to get the trace of the Kronecker delta in four dimensions. That's 4. Plus u times u, that's minus 1. So we get 3. So the trace of that is 3. And that indicates that what's left over after projection against the projection orthogonal to u is something effectively three-dimensional. So we kill one dimension by killing the u component, and we end up with something effectively three-dimensional left over. So this one is obvious. This one I'll ask you to prove. This is just a very simple manipulation that I think will be helpful to learn how to manipulate these things. And then the other essential property is the one that I just derived, the fact that P acting on U gives 0. Okay, so that's just stuff that I need. And now I want to get to, well, at least the first step of decomposition. And I'm aware that I'm running out of time, so we won't go too far into this, but we'll pick this up again next week. Okay, so ultimately what we'll want to do is to decompose the gradient of u in terms of the smallest pieces we can identify. And that's going to be the ultimate goal, but we'll turn to that next week. Right now I'll start a little bit simpler and I'll say, let's take a vector, you know, any good old generic vector in space-time, and let's decompose it into a component along u and a component orthogonal to u. So that's going to be the simplest idea. And we can describe this pretty easily. So the whole point here is that by introducing this flow, you know, this congruence of word lines, we're basically introducing at every point in space-time a preferred time direction. So we can say that, you know, observers that move with that velocity field become, you know, preferred observers in our description of what's going on here. And we can take proper time along those word lines to be, you know, preferred notion of time in space-time. Now, generally speaking, there's no such thing in general relativity, but if we have a vector field that's given to us from whatever context, maybe fluid dynamics, we do have a preferred flow that defines a preferred direction of time, and we're going to think of this as the time direction, and all the orthogonal directions to that time direction will be a preferred notion of the spatial directions. So that's the first idea. So the so u and its integral curves define a preferred time. And we're going to call that the time direction. At every point in space-time, we have a preferred time direction. And then all of the orthogonal directions those are going to be preferred spatial directions. and we're going to think of this as space. So it's really the presence of that, you know, vector field that allows us to do that. In, you know, in general terms, you know, if we're not given a special vector field to play with, we don't have those notions of preferred times or preferred, you know, preferred spaces. But here we do. And the idea will be, well, the first thing we're going to do when we want to decompose things is to decompose anything in terms of time components and spatial components. And that will mean geometrically component long U versus orthogonal components. So if we're given a vector field A alpha that can be anything we want it to be, then in general, there's going to be some component that's going to be aligned with U, and then there's going to be some reminder to this that's going to be orthogonal to U. So we can decompose a vector that's fairly complicated in space-time because we have four components into a breakdown between one component along time and three remaining components. The definition of the, you know, orthogonal piece of A is that, well, it's defined to satisfy the requirement that it is actually orthogonal to U. So here we have four components. Here we isolate one, the one along time. And here, because of that constraint, we started out with four, but we impose one constraint, and we're dealing with three components. So that's the idea, right? Start with something complicated and try to break it down into smaller pieces. And the smaller pieces are going to be the component of the vector along U and the other components that are orthogonal to U. So that's the idea. And, you know, if we're given a vector, what we would like to do is to be able to compute those two pieces from any vector that's presented to us. And that's very simple because we have the ingredients available to us at this stage. So, for example, I can take that vector and I can take the scalar product of the vector with our preferred time vector U. And if we just make the substitution here, we're going to get A multiplying U, and then we're going to get U multiplying A, you know, A perp. And that's defined to be 0, that's defined to be minus 1. So we get immediately that the time-like component, or the time component of that vector, is simply minus the scalar product of the vector with U. So if we're given any vector A, we can always extract the A component by taking that scalar product. And that comes with a minus sign. And then the other thing we can do is to multiply across with the projection operator. So if we do that instead, so I'll take, let's see, how do I want to write this? I'll write it as P beta alpha A alpha. So if I project against the, you know, if I act with the projection operator, then what do I get? Well, if I plug in what the projection operator stands for, we get all of this. And that's going to be acting on the vector A, which is itself decomposed into those two pieces. And what do we get from all of this? Well, the connector delta is going to be returning exactly the same thing. And then this term over here, well, we get U multiplying U, so that's minus 1. So we're going to get, sorry, I did something wrong here. Those were supposed to be beta indices because I'm using the Kronecker delta and contract with the alpha index here. But yeah, returning here, we get U multiplying U, that's minus 1. So we get minus A U beta. And of course, that kills that. And that multiplying this is 0 because A by definition, A perp, multiplied, you know, projected against U is 0. So I'll just say that the last term in the multiplication is guaranteed to vanish. So what's happened here, we kill the two component, you know, the two terms along U, and what's left over is the perpendicular component. So the point is, if we want to introduce a decomposition like this, we can actually calculate each component in turn. A will turn out to be given by the scalar product between A and the U vector, and then the perpendicular component is going to be given by an action of the projection operator. So that's what the projection operator does. It takes anything, and then it kills a component along U, and it keeps only what's orthogonal to U. And that's what we see here. So that's the idea. So the first, you know, the first step in decomposing an object like a vector, you know, once we have a preferred, you know, time-like direction like this, is to basically break it down into a time and spatial components. And we can do it for a vector, and basically for a vector, that's all we would ever do. But we can apply exactly the same ideas to a tensor. And that's what we're going to do next time when we work out the full decomposition of the vector gradient. The first thing we're going to do is to break it down in terms of time and spatial components. And then we can look at what's left over and see if we can further break it down in terms of symmetric, antisymmetric, blah, blah, blah. So really apply the two layers of decomposition, one time versus space, the other one, you know, symmetric versus antisymmetric, trace-free versus trace. All of those things, we're going to incorporate all of those ideas together and work out a full decomposition of grad U in a way that incorporates everything. And then we're going to look at all the pieces separately and see if we can recognize their separate meaning. So I'm going to stop here because we're basically done. But this is, you know, this is what we're going to be doing next time. We're going to apply those ideas to a tensor as opposed to just a vector. So any questions before we quit for the day? Okay, sounds good. So we'll see you all next week.